Welcome back, folks. There's been some recent announcements of movement relative to the Lindy Boggs Medical Center after nearly two decades of sitting vacant, and it looks like the demolition is soon to begin. Michelle Schlafly, Secretary of the Mid-City Neighborhood Association Board, joins us to discuss saying, Michelle, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Noel. How are you?
Doing well. I got to imagine there is a sigh of relief. I don't know. You know, I drive by there periodically. I got to tell you that building on that property is one of the most butt ugly I've seen in the entire city. And I'd be glad for it to be gone. Your thoughts?
Of course. Our neighborhood has been fighting for a very long time to get movement on the property. And I think Woodward, the current owner, has owned it, I think, in partnership at one time since 2017. So nearly 10 years since this current owner has had the building. And while, you know, additional historic tax credits and funding had sort of dried up over the years, you know, at some point, someone had to address this problem. And we, while public dollars are being used as part of the creative project that they have done now with this idea of creating a infrastructure retention tank in the lower part of the property, we are happy to just, as part of that, yes, the building will have to come down. And that is the creative solution that the city has partnered with Woodward in doing so. And I believe as of this morning's council meeting, it is officially approved. There was something on the agenda at the council meeting this morning, I think finalizing some of the funding that the city will provide. But as far as the building coming down, we did have the wonderful meeting that Woodward did provide for the neighborhood on this past Tuesday and did, you know, sort of give us a calendar of events, if you will, of how the building will be coming down. And, you know, in part, they provided sort of a seven-step process. First, they do have some asbestos remaining and that they do have some abatement to take care of before actual demolition will commence. And it will be a very slow demolition and a very deliberate demolition where they're going to start from the Conti Street side of the building. They're going to take down the little power plant building first. And then they're going to just sort of, they also, I believe, the building is actually still connected to the St. Margaret's facility. So there mm-hmm. has to be a separation created there as well. So I think it's going to be little by little by little, you know, I think they estimated abatement to be anywhere from 2 weeks to up to a month, and then we'll probably start seeing some real progress. So it's exciting for Mid-City because we are one of the most beautiful areas of the city. We have these beautiful neutral grounds on Canal Street and Norman Francis, and we have just beautiful oak trees everywhere. We really are a lovely area of the city that, you know, we're very proud to live in. So yeah. As far as getting this building down after 20 years, we cannot, you know, we're very happy. We're very, very happy. We're happy to support Woodward in their efforts. And while they don't know what's planned next, aside from this retention tank that they, you know, this water retention that they plan to build, you know, there are no specific plans just yet. And so we hope, you know, we hope whatever they do build is not just necessarily beneficial for our neighborhood, but, you know, also beneficial for the city as a whole. You know, we are centrally located. That's why we're Mid-City. We're the heart of the city. And it's you know, it's a great place to live. It's why I've
It's
lived
one
here.
Of the most convenient neighborhoods in the entire city, right? I mean, you can get anywhere from
really
there
is.
Quick.
Yes, that is. That is one of the really the big secrets. It's out now, so you know. But no, it's actually why I live here. I mean, I'm born and raised in New Orleans, but you know, we've lived in this neighborhood for nearly 30 years. So it's very lovely. But as far as the building coming down, we are. I will say, you know, Mercy is near and dear to my heart because I'm born there. I had family who worked there on staff for many years. And the Sisters of Mercy, you know, they started something many, many years ago. And the Mid-City Neighborhood Organization is currently applying for an historic plaque to commemorate the Sisters of Mercy, because that building, believe it or not, has been around now, you know, since 1953. So, you know, granted, Hurricane Katrina destroyed that, and it's been that way now, you know, literally 20 years. And so we are hoping to commemorate that site, because at one time it was a vibrant, wonderful neighborhood hospital in our neighborhood. And so, not many people remember how wonderful that building was, and how wonderful the doctors, the nurses, the staff, just having that hospital in our neighborhood was such a comfort. And so now that it's going to be something different, and the skyline is going to be something very different, you know, that's, we don't know what's going there. So I think Woodward is proposing something along the lines of mixed-use development, you know, where there's businesses and, you know, some housing, restaurants, things of that nature. But it does have to make sense to them financially, is what we've been told. Additionally, they, you know, they're hoping to also provide, you know, on-site parking, because, you know, we are a neighborhood. And so it's hard to find parking, you know. But the demolition's going to take, you know, a while. And I think people aren't going to, they're not going to understand that it's not an immediate implosion. It's not, it's literally going to be clawing away, clawing away, clawing away. So,
well, I'm told that building is built like, incredible, you know, other than a flood, it could probably have withstood any hurricane, tornado, or otherwise.
It's funny you say that. Yes, it's unfortunate that this building could not be reused. We understand why it can't be reused, especially at this point. It's just been wallowing for so long. And it's, you know, I've been in the building recently, and so I understand it's very difficult to watch, to see it. It's a graffiti haven. It's an urban explorer's dream, if you will.
Yeah, so, unfortunately.
Unfortunately. And our hope, you know, our hope is that the site can be, you know, well-maintained during the demolition, that people stay away, that people let this job happen, you know, and let it get done, even though it is going to take multiple months.
So, Michelle, I wanted to ask, from your perspective, because you mentioned this a couple of times, this building down and out as a result of Katrina floodwaters, from a neighborhood perspective, lessons learned.
Oh, there's a lot of lessons to be learned here. Accountability by both the city leaders and the owners. I don't know how else to say it. You shouldn't be allowed to buy a giant building and just let it sit while you wait for historic tax credits to be approved or to be found. That the ability for an owner to secure a building long term, you know, you shouldn't be allowed to mothball something this size. That there should be laws in place that if you can't redevelop something after, let's just give it an idea, a 2-year period, you know, to find the necessarily dollars to do what you'd like to do, then move on. And, you know, but still, you know, the city has had to step in, and we don't feel that this project would have happened if the city had not helped. That's all I'm going to say, is that at some point the public-private partnership did have to take place. And, you know, while public money is being used, albeit for infrastructure, I still think that, you know, private property owners really do need to be held accountable. You know, we hold residential homeowners accountable, we hope, you know, for things that are, you know, high grass, things of that nature.
And that really goes back to the original owners of the building at the time of the storm, right? I mean,
I think they basically,
you know, they were the ones that walked away and abandoned the building.
Correct. That is correct. And there were subsequent owners who also put covenants in place that Mercy could not be reopened as a hospital. There are also owners. The Mid-City Neighborhood Organization actually did fight. I think it was Victory Development at the time. They wanted to put a Target and a Macy's on that site. And so the neighborhood organization did fight that during that time. We didn't want giant big box, and we still hope that big box is not on the table. So agreed that ownership, you know, is responsibility. And I don't think that we have held these owners. You know, I know Joe Yeager is no longer on this earth, but I do know that, you know, he also has held a lot of these big properties at one time. So I think that, you know, ownership responsibility and also ownership, you know, Woodward has actually come to the table for our organization. In the end, they have been, I would say, mostly upfront with what's going on, and whether we like the answer to that or not, they still at least came to the table, provided information and updates, and have helped our organization, you know, get information out to our neighborhood. And so, you know, we're trying, I think in the end, this current owner, I hope, is going to do what they say they plan to do. So,
yeah.
And I hope the city holds them accountable once the building comes down. You know, okay.
Yeah, I applaud the city for working out a way, you know, to find, and if it's stormwater retention, that's actually a requirement now on a lot of these projects. I had no idea that the basement of this facility could hold, what is it, 5 million or 4 million?
They're saying 4 million gallons.
4 million gallons of stormwater.
But that is real or not real. I think what they noted at the meeting on Tuesday is that once the demolition is complete and the debris is all removed, there is still a topographical survey that will be done to see.
Right.
I think there's some still unknowns there that, you know, the intention is
sure
there. So let's hope that does come to fruition.
No, absolutely. And, you know, and this is a good example of a strong neighborhood association coming together and protecting their interests, right?
Of course. We want our neighborhood to continue to thrive and do wonderful things. And, you know, we want people to live in our neighborhood, enjoy our neighborhood. You know, we are proximity to the downtown area, you know, with streetcar access, and just everything is so close and nearby and walkable. And so, no, we want to keep our neighborhood in that way. And, you know, access to the bayou, access to just groceries. And we're very fortunate to live where we live, even access to City Park. The park is very close. So the interstate is close. So it's there are schools. There are, you know, Warren Easton has been a huge supporter of our neighborhood. So we're very, very blessed. And we hope that once this gets started, once it gets off the ground, that I think people will be surprised. You know, it's going to be a little shocking to lose that skyline, that giant building in the middle of our neighborhood, you know, to have that space open again. So we'll see. I mean, it's been, yeah, they built that building, I think it's 1953 is when the Sisters of Mercy opened with their nursing school and the original hospital before the addition of the chapel and the whole porte-cochere on the front end of the building. So I'm sorry for the loss of the structure. I really am. It's you know, hits your heart, but
right.
Oh, well, you know what?
Well,
it's time to move forward.
Yeah, the time has come. It's time to move forward. The sense I have, and I'm curious if you have the same sense, this administration, meaning the Moreno administration with the new council, they have their eye on the ball. And that's the sense that I have thus far. They seem to really be have a higher attention to details, and let's just put it that way, than the previous administration, which I think is a good thing.
Oh, I do think it's a good thing. At this point, I mean, Katrina is 20 years ago. It's time for people to say, let's move forward. You know, we don't have to live in the past. It's time for us to move forward. And I do think that this administration, whether or not, I think what I give this administration a lot of credit for is the creativity that is happening behind the scenes, where they can find ways to find money, to find grants, to find available money, to make money, to move our city forward in a different direction. I don't necessarily believe from an economic standpoint that this project is going to be, it's going to take a long time for viability to really see that viability, at least from this project. But, you know, I think, you know, Mayor Moreno is doing her best. And I appreciate her communication. I appreciate how open she is with the public. And she's on social media, you know, giving updates and things of that nature. But I applaud the city for those efforts. And I pray that we continue to move forward. That's really... That's what our goal is, as you know, from the Mid-City Neighborhood Organization standpoint. And, you know, we also just quick shout out to our neighborhood is we're getting a new sculpture, you know, at Canal Street and South Norman C. Francis through the MCNO did a proposal for in conjunction with Arts New Orleans, and we were approved. And so we're going to finally get, you know, something new that's, you know, not been there for 10 years. So we're very excited about that. That process should be up and coming at the end of this month. So, you know, there's all reasons to be positive right now.
Absolutely. So, sounds like y'all got a couple of wins under your belt, and that's always a good thing. And these are must haves. These things have to be done. Unfortunately, you know, sometimes we wish it didn't have to be this way, but I think I think you guys have waited enough, you know, and it's time to, as you said, move on, get it done.
Agreed. And you're so kind to have us on this morning to give us a shout out.
Yep. Congratulations to y'all. I know it's been a long time, and I know you still got a long road to hoe, and there will be some disruption in the neighborhood as a result of tearing that building down. That's just the necessary evil of the job that needs to be done. But at some point in time, there will be something there that we can all brag about for sure. Michelle Schlafly, Secretary of the Mid-City Neighborhood Association Board, thank you so much for joining us. Truly appreciate it, and have a great weekend.
You too, Neil. Thank you for your time. Bye-bye.
Thank you. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. When we come back, we'll visit with Brandon Buck, Research Fellow in Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato. We'll talk about this on-again, off-again conflict in the Middle East. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We've now entered into a new era of the Iranian war conflict, and it seems as though the patience of a whole lot of folks are waning. Brandon Buck joins us, Research Fellow in Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. Brandon, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You know, what we've not seen from the president for a while relative to Iranian officials is he hadn't really been calling them names. Well, I believe yesterday or the day before, he referred to them as scum. And it seems as though he has completely lost his patience relative to the way that they're conducting themselves with this on again, off again, on again. And I'm hearing this morning they're trying to get back on the track yet again. Where do we go from here?
Well, the president says a lot of things. He also said on the flight back from Europe that the Iranians are desperate for a deal, as he said so many times before. So where do we go from here? It's tough to say. I mean, you know, I sort of jokingly said that it's only a ceasefire if it's from the ceasefire region of France. And what this is more like a managed reduction in hostilities. I think both sides are trying to reestablish deterrence. And they obviously have distrust of the other, clearly, over the course of, you know, many decades of relations, but even just within the course of establishing the MOU. So I think the efforts on both sides to get back on track are sincere, because the material constraints that got the MOU process started, they very much remain, as do the political concerns for Washington.
When we so what is it that the Iranians really need to do to show that they're in good faith? I mean, it seems that opening the strait, that's the leverage point, that's the friction point. Why are they so unwilling to abandon what they're doing? I mean, it just seems that they're not going to be able to put tolls on shipping. We're not going to allow international shipping to be impeded that way and impacted that way. So at what point do they say, okay, we're done with that?
Well, it's the biggest lever that they have. I mean, so at what point do they say that we're done with that? Is it the point in which they believe that the United States is going to follow through on its concessions laid out in the MOU? And I mean, I think that's their biggest concern here, is that they will have in the back of their minds the suspicion that the process that they're currently involved in is not merely a end to the longer history of acrimonious relations with the West and the United States, but merely just a respite for both sides to refit and rearm. So I think for them it's a matter of sequencing. And to the credit of the Trump administration, they indeed sequenced this correctly from their point of view. They began to release sanctions on Iranian oil that has since been rescinded. So I think for this to get going again, the Iranians are going to need to feel that this process is indeed genuine and not merely just a current lull in the fighting.
It seems to me the rhetoric that's gone on around the room as opposed to in the room may be causing more harm than good, and is really shaking, not only the markets, but the insurers that insure the vessels that have to travel through the Strait of Hormuz and otherwise. And so you have now multiple economic friction points outside the control of these folks, because they just keep engaging in the rhetoric, meaning both sides, the U.S. as well as Iran.
Yeah, for sure. And, there are three major parties here, the United States, Israel, and, of course, Iran. And, one of the first clauses of the MOU was that both sides were going to restrain from, making various threats. And the president, the very next day after signing the MOU, was making threats, threatening to kidnap the negotiators, which is not exactly reassuring to the other side. And, of course, the Iranians have done their own share of violations, of course, shooting on those three vessels a few days ago. And, I think it's important to recall that, countries are not black boxes, be it the United States or Israel or Iran, and they have political spectrums just like ours, maybe not just like ours, mm-hmm. but they certainly have them. And then the Iranians have hardliners in their own government that don't want to negotiate with the United States, certainly not at this point. So what we might be seeing is just those folks reasserting their own dominance within their own government. So I think we're in store for another few days, maybe a week or so of horizontal escalation for the purposes of reestablishing deterrence on either side within, and then again some sort of renewed effort to contain or hopefully end the conflict.
Been listening to a number of talking heads yesterday and last night talking about the fact that maybe it's time to move to a different aspect, namely regime change, mm-hmm. and continue to talk and articulate about the ability of the Iranian people to take control of their country. I have a real difficult time seeing this through that lens. Your thoughts?
Yeah, for sure. I'm generally a pessimistic person, and I try not to make too many predictions, especially in this arena, because it's been pretty unpredictable. But like as I said earlier, the material constraints remain. The United States is still maybe not critically low on key munitions like interceptors and precision guided weapons, but there are now legitimate concerns about being able to meet other contingencies elsewhere in the world now because of how long this war has gone on. And so that remains. So like unless Washington got, a massive backfill of those ordinances secretly, then those concerns still remain. And they're also certainly, the continued economic ramifications, particularly if oil gets back up to $100 a barrel, if not more, those things will continue to constrain, or at least ought to constrain, Washington's thinking here. So if they do try to go whole hog into some kind of, you know, regime change operation or some sort of covert iteration thereof, they're going to again run into those constraints. So it's difficult to see how that's going to be seriously on the menu as far as policymakers go.
And as this says, this increase in kinetic activity by the Iranians, how surprised have you been that there's like no presence of the Houthis in Yemen and not a whole lot? Well, I can understand more so Hezbollah. They kind of have their hands tied right now with with what the IDF is doing up there in southern Lebanon. But the Houthis have been kind of interestingly quiet here.
That's right. I mean, it's that's anyone's guess. I mean, it could be Tehran is just keeping them in their back pocket. Perhaps they feel like they don't need to utilize them right now, and so they're, you know, they're best being served as a reserve force for them rather than to use them right now. If I'm correct, and you know, really what we're in store for is more of a horizontal escalation than a vertical one, then this, at least from Tehran's perspective, it's probably best to keep them in reserve rather than use them now.
We have met with the Iranians in person many times. What we were told were very productive meetings really haven't revealed itself that way, and had, in my view, hadn't really come to fruition. Is there a better way to coordinate with these individuals?
You know, if I had an answer to that, I probably wouldn't be on the phone with you right now. you know, honestly, I don't know.
Where would you be, Brandon? Tell us, where would you be?
hopefully making more money. I don't know. I think ultimately what's going to happen here is that both sides will continue to tire each other out. And the president frankly just looks exhausted. And I know I'm just kind of
he does.
You know, I'm just going on vibes here, but he looks like he's over it. And so I think, again, both sides will lob missiles and rockets at one another for over the course of a few days, maybe a few weeks, and then we'll be right back to where we were. I mean, you know, again, I'm loath to make predictions here, but when all of this started, you know, I was forced to make one, and basically it was that the United States and Iran would settle into a kind of, I don't want to say Cold War, but a kind of pseudo belligerent state in which they kind of do this forever. And I think the president, I mean, perhaps thinks that as long as he can keep oil at below $100 a barrel and maintain the economic damage, he can do just that. That's certainly plausible, particularly if they reinstall the blockade and try to keep kinetic activity, if you will, at a minimum. Perhaps they believe that they can do that for the foreseeable future.
It's almost as if he's mentioned this several times, like bridges, and, you know, of inflicting some indirect pain on the citizens of Iran. I don't know if that is going to be the next stage, but I'm curious whether or not motivates these folks. It doesn't look like they care much about the well-being of their electorate. They kill them at will. But, you know, it's funny to find, I mean, not funny, but, you know, where's the pain point for them? And I guess that's exactly what's frustrating the president. It seems like no one historically has ever been able to find it.
Yeah, and bombing alone doesn't have a very good historical track record when it comes to achieving maximalist aims. And, you know, regime change is a maximalist aim, and historically those require maximal effort. And so bombing alone has not really had much of doesn't have a very good track record for achieving those aims. Iran's a very large country. It can soak up a lot of damage. You know, there have been various leaks and stuff out of the various offices here in Washington, you know, saying that, you know, anywhere from three quarters to half of Iran's missile stockpiles remain intact, if not buried, but nevertheless still retrievable and fireable. And so we are in, what is effectively a war with attrition with a regime that has a whole lot more to lose than the average American does. That gives them escalation dominance, despite them being a far weaker power. So that's where we are. And it's difficult to see how anyone in Washington will be willing to pay the cost to achieve those maximal aims.
Were you surprised when the president, I believe yesterday, said, maybe we'll just take Karg Island?
Yeah, well, he's been saying that a lot. And am I surprised? I mean, unfortunately, I'm not surprised. I mean, there are, competing institutions here in D.C. who have proven profiting that idea since the start of the war, if not long before. And, again, this is something that appeals to the president, this idea of taking the oil, right, as an element of his Venezuela policy. It informed his desire to stay in Syria longer than perhaps he even would have wanted himself. He is kind of a divided mind there. And so I think this idea of seizing the resources for the purposes of either negotiation or U.S. benefit is something that appeals to him because that idea has appealed to him in other theaters. If they fall through on it, is another thing altogether. And I think that is far more logistically difficult than its supporters have put on, and I think perhaps in Washington they realize that as well.
Yeah. Well, I guess over the next 3, 4 to 5 days is going to be pretty telling as to where this is going to go next, and whether or not there really is this desire and ability to get together and try and put all of this back on track. The level of distrust has to be greater than it ever was, far greater than when we started this process, one would think, right?
Yeah, pretty much. So yeah. I guess we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, absolutely. Brandon Buck, thank you so much for joining us. Truly appreciate your time, your insight, research fellow in foreign policy studies at the Cato Institute. We love the work that you guys do. Keep up the great work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Open Heart Jewelers talk and text line. Love to hear from you. Give us a shout. We'll be right back. Welcome back, folks. What we have coming up after the top of the hour news break is we're going to visit with Rafael Goyeneche, president of the Metropolitan Crime Commission, and we'll continue our conversation about what's actually happening relative to this indictment of Louisiana AG Liz Murrell. The Louisiana Supreme Court has appointed Judge Robert Chasson to sit as the ad hoc judge because all of the judges on the criminal district court have recused themselves. Judge Chasson, a Democrat, will be handling this case moving forward. So we'll be interested in following that and everything that's going to be going on relative to this, as motions will be filed by the Attorney General, I'm sure, in the coming days. And once Judge Chasson is able to take control of this case, I'm sure there will be deadlines that will be set up and things of that nature. So it will be interesting to see what will unfold next. WWL wants you to win tickets to TripAdvisor's number one attraction in New Orleans, the National World War II Museum. Right now you can register to win a family four-pack once a day at WWL.com/contest. And that's not all. From now until September 1st, general admission tickets at the museum are 50% off for Louisiana residents. Beat the heat, bring the family, and step inside stories that changed the world from the National World War II Museum and WWL. And I got to tell you, you will love visiting the museum. There is a lot to see. And Houdat Nation, are you getting ready for some football? Saints training camp is less than 3 weeks away, and the team holds their first practice on Wednesday, July the 29th. Houdat from all of us at Saints Radio WWL. And you can go to WWL.com and then our Saints page and check out Jeff Nowak's 53-man roster projection. after off-season workouts, and we all know that it'll be a great read as well. So you may want to check that out. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. On the text line, I timed my grocery run today to be back in time to hear Ravi Goyeneche's latest update on the grand jury, a.k.a. Ringling Brothers. And that's exactly what it is. And we'll be right back with Ravi Goyeneche, president of the Metropolitan Crime Commission. We'll also talk about some federal cases and updates in federal court. And also we'll discuss the Metropolitan Crime Commission Awards Luncheon. In fact, we will be broadcasting live from the Awards Luncheon this year. We're excited about doing that as well. We'll be right back with Raphael Goyeneche. Stay with us. This is Newell on WWL.